Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Everybody, I hope you enjoyed our new jungle-themed podcast opening theme that I spent about 5 minutes on. So the production value is really high on that one. I hope you enjoyed it. Welcome to our new mini season, the Jungle Girls. And I don't know, I should think of a better name for it, but we'll just call it the Jungle Girl mini. The Jungle Girl mini season until I can find something I can pronounce.
I've been thinking of it as the Jungle Girls of Italy.
Yeah, that'll do. Or maybe we should call it Jungala.
Well, I have to admit that it took me forcing my eyes to stare at the screen repeatedly to make myself spell Gungala correctly, because I kept wanting to switch the G with a D. Yeah. In the English dub, I swear sometimes it sounds like that.
Yeah, so in the English dub, they spell it all kinds of ways. But hey, we're getting ahead of ourselves. I'd like to, first of all, introduce... My name is Adrian, of course. I'd like to introduce my co-host, the ever-reliable podcaster extraordinaire, Rod Barnett.
Hello, I'm glad to be here.
Now, Rod, this was all your fault.
Yes, I will take the blame for this. The same way in which you must take the blame for Italian comedies that we cover.
So happy to take that one. So do you want to just give us a bit of background on why? That's it. Question mark.
it's a fine and good question. I have been fascinated with Jungle Girl films and comic books and, oh man, Pulp Fiction for a very long period of time. And I guess it all dates back to my original reading of the first several Tarzan novels when I was a kid. But I think that, that was all pre-puberty. And I think that puberty explains my adult fascination with the Jungle Girl subgenre. It's a very strange kind of story. I'm not going to pretend that there's not something adolescent and bizarre about having a fascination with Jungle Girl stories, but at the same time, they have been going on for a very long period of time. I mean, the earliest example would probably be from about 1904. There was this novel called Green Mansions that kind of introduced, for better or worse, the concept of the forest dwelling, non-African native girl who's at one with her surroundings and friendly with the animals and kind of accepted as either some kind of strange pale goddess or something along these lines. And since then, of course, Green Mansions was adapted into a film in the 50s. Do you know who played the Jungle Girl in the adaptation of Green Mansions in the 50s?
Not a clue.
Audrey Hepburn.
Oh. Okay, that wasn't what I was expecting.
That's always one of those moments where it's a wonderful card to throw on the table and go, ahaha.
Yeah, fair
So
enough.
that's not the first, of course. I think that for most cinema goers, their first introduction to the kind of Jungle Girl idea may have been the second Johnny Weissmuller Tarzan film, where you get Jane having been assimilated into the jungle and cavorting in the uncut version with a fair amount of swimming nudity in the film, although apparently that the swimming nudes were done by a stunt double of some sort, or a nude double. Nevertheless, the idea of adolescent male eyes right there on the verge of discovering that those girls are much more interesting than he originally thought, probably explains a lot of fascination with Jungle Girls. I will admit, even just last night, I started reading a collection of Jungle Girl comic books from I believe the 50s, called Judy of the Jungle. It's like Judy, really? So we're going to use every name humanly imaginable, but it's like, does it start with a J? We'll use it. Does it start with any other letter? We'll use that too. I guess one of the most famous would be probably Sheena, because Sheena got turned into Sheena was a pulp a series of pulp stories that got turned into a television show with Irish McCallum in the 50s, and then they even made a film in 1984 that I
Is that
completely ignored.
Farrah? Is it Farrah Fawcett or somebody like that?
Oh, no.
Who's in that one?
The film in the
Somebody.
80s was actually oh my goodness, I just completely blanked on her name. Tanya Roberts.
Oh, yeah.
And what's really weird is that I completely ignored the Sheena movie from 84 when I was a teenager, because I just assumed it was terrible. And then just a few years ago, I finally decided to watch it and realized, it's really a very good adaptation of the story, and I kind of enjoy the crap out of it. I really do enjoy that film. But take that with the Jungle Girl size grain of salt. I already have admitted that I'm a huge fan of this stuff. And the thing that you get into with the Jungle Girl films that I think that we're going to concentrate on is just a handful of them that were produced, strangely enough, as exploitation films. I can't imagine why.
Yep,
In Italy in
bizarre.
the late 60s.
Yes, I've picked out four for us to try and cover, and they're all 1968 or 69. So it was a very concentrated period of Jungle Girl exploitation, whatever we want to call it. And I was also wondering whether it's got some origins in H. Rider Haggard's She.
Yes.
Again, the idea of the sort of white goddess in Darkest Africa. It's kind of colonial, isn't
It's a whole lot
it?
racist. Let's be blunt, okay?
Yeah, fair enough. Yes, we'll certainly probably pick up on some of that when we get into today's film. So today we are talking about the film, which is known in English as Gungala, the Black Panther Girl, but I much prefer its Italian title, Gungala la Pantera Nuda, which I think we can all translate in our heads without any help from Google. Now, interestingly, so we've watched the English dub, and I swear, and I'm going to play the music here. I swear there's a song, the theme song, and this singer is screaming this girl's name over and over in the song. But
Yes.
she's saying Gangala, which, I mean, Gangala, that sounds medical. That sounds like a bit of your body, the Gangala. But anyway, so here's a clip from the theme for Gungala, aka Gangala.
Someone that someone
But in the Italian dub, it's different. They're singing something completely different. So here is that. Make up your minds which version you prefer. But it's so weird. Gangala. What?
It can be. I hate to say it. It is a bit of an earworm. I was rewatching the beginning of the film earlier this morning and realizing, man, that is going to be in my head all again today, isn't it? Yeah.
It reminded me, I haven't done enough research to see who was singing that, but it reminded me of the theme for, I think it's The Big Gun Down. That has a similar level of sort of screamy woman singing the singing the song. Anyway, yeah. So there you go. So Gangala, La Pantera Nuda from 1968, directed by our old friend Roger Rockefeller.
Okay. Yes. Here's the thing: when you pick this to be our first of the, out of the gate. I did not pay attention until after I'd watched it to who directed it. Started poking around, doing a little research, and then went, well, of course, this is exactly why. You're such a fan of this Rockefeller guy.
I know. I'm so predictable. Now, what's interesting, so obviously, for those of you who are unaware, Roger Rockefeller was the bizarre and quite hilarious anglicized name chosen by one of my favorite guys, Ruggiero Deodato. Now, given that 10 or so, 10 years later, a little bit longer than 10 years later, he would be very famous or infamous for films that he made in the jungle. I thought this film would, there would be more interest around this film because this is his first jungle film.
Mm-hmm.
But even today on the IMDb, there are only 2 reviews.
I know.
And on Letterboxd, there are only 6. So it's like barely anybody is interested in this film, has gone back to, like, it would be really interesting. Somebody could write a paper tracing Deodato's jungle movies, you know, through this one and then through into the 70s and obviously up to Cannibal Holocaust and then beyond, obviously, because he still kept going back to the jungle in the 80s.
Mm-hmm. With Cut and Run and a few, yeah, several others. Yeah.
But this is his first go. And it's really interesting to sort of watch this film thinking, this guy was going to make Cannibal Holocaust 12 years later.
and thereby change the world.
Exactly. But, and of course I should mention here, if anyone wants to hear what Rod and I have to say about Cannibal Holocaust, we did record a podcast on that about 6 years ago, probably.
Yes.
So do dig back through the Bloody Pit archives. I'll tweet it out at some point as well. But yeah, so this is, so Deodato, this was his first official film as director. And again, we also covered this on your podcast, again, maybe 6 years ago. The first film that he technically was the director of, although his name was not on the poster, was Hercules, Prisoner of Evil.
Yes.
Which officially was an Antonio Margheriti film, but he was too busy. And so he trusted his friend and assistant director, Ruggiero Deodato, to just do it for him, basically. So he had got experience as a director, but this was his first where he was actually officially the one in charge. So I was reading what he had to say about making this movie in the book that I've referred to before on this podcast, Cannibal Holocaust and the Savage Cinema of Ruggiero Deodato, which is by Fab Press, an excellent book. My copy is actually signed by him, which is pretty cool. Anyway, so he says here, my first film was Gangala, La Pantera Nuda, the sequel to another film, which of course we haven't mentioned yet. But yes, this is indeed a sequel to Gangala, La Vergine della Giungla, a.k.a. Gangala, the Virgin of the Jungle.
Yes, of course, and it being a sequel and not having seen the original, the film, the first film, it explains why I was lost the entire time.
Yeah, exactly. So the first film was directed by Romano Ferrara, who co-wrote the script for that one as well. And from what I've read of that one, I've read some reviews and descriptions, and Gangala basically spends most of the time just in the trees watching what everybody does and then doesn't really do much until the end. And that's almost entirely what happens here, but she gets more to do in this film.
Yeah.
So Romano Ferrara was also a co-writer on this one, but I don't think they liked what he was doing, so they brought Deodato in. He says, we filmed it in Kenya and part of it in Italy at De Paola Studios. They shot it in Italy first. He says, after having looked at the scene shot in Italy, we decided to go to Kenya for 3 weeks to finish the film. I thought that was interesting that they shot all the studio stuff first. And this is a film that is clearly shot in a studio for the most part.
Yeah, big chunks of it are just obviously stage bound. Some of the
fakest looking jungle you've ever seen.
How about that weird little bitty set with the little blue water pool and flamingo birds? That Gangala is prancing about in all on her lonesome there for the longest time. Just like, this just screams TV budget set.
Yeah. And she's built herself a little Swiss Family Robinson style home. Which I wasn't sure. Well, we'll get into the plot in a minute, but how old was she when her parents crashed in the jungle?
Okay.
Like, she was old. Was she old enough to rig up a house?
Yeah,
I know what a house looks like.
I don't know. See, that's the thing. The age of the character, I kept wondering, right? Because clearly she is, quote unquote, of age, depending on what the age of consent in whatever country we're going to pretend this is taking place in actually might be. But the strange thing is, without having seen the first film, which maybe would have given us a clue as to how old she was when, you know, the plane crash and her parents died. Yeah. Lots of planes crash in the African jungle with lots of family units. It's very strange. So that's how so many jungle girls just scatter the countryside. But there's no idea. I have no idea. I mean, the actress herself, you know, she's, I'm assuming in her mid 20s, and that's about what she looks like in the film. But it's just a guess on our part, you know.
I just thought, you know, she's rigged up some pulleys and some systems, and she seems to know what she's doing. But of course, you know, this does actually happen in real life. There was that story just recently in the Amazon in Colombia, where those four children were killed in a plane. Their mother was killed in the crash, but they survived, and they survived in the jungle for 40 days before they were found. So yeah, this kind of thing, and obviously it's in terms of fiction, it's got its roots in the Tarzan story as well, who is the ultimate raised in the jungle by animals. And it's about, well, mind you, did Tarzan come before the Jungle Book or afterwards?
No, the Kipling stuff, sure. I think it's
is that before
the late Tarzan? 1800s. The first Tarzan story was 1905? I'd have to check. I can't remember.
It might all go back to Mowgli anyway, in some way, I suppose.
Yeah.
It's a very well-trodden path. Either way. much like the paths that they go through in the sets, they are very well-trodden. So, I mean, we'll get to the Italy stuff. We'll get to the Africa stuff. We'll talk a bit more about that when we get into talking about the plot. But of course, we need to talk about the star of the film and also the star of the first film. Oh, and the reason I didn't pick the first one, by the way, is just because I wanted to talk about Ruggiero Deodato again.
I am not surprised.
My main reason for choosing this one. But also, from what I read, this is the better of the two, which doesn't say that much for the first film. So Kitty Swan, also her real name is Kirsten Svanholm, and she was from Copenhagen in Denmark. Big European star in the 60s. And yeah, I thought we should spend some time talking about her, because she's actually, she wasn't somebody I was particularly aware of before, though I realize now I have seen her in other movies. But she has a really fascinating story. And also, by coincidence, I was just about 6 weeks ago in Copenhagen, which is one of my most favorite places I've ever been to. Hmm. Absolutely loved Copenhagen. I highly recommend it to anybody who's listening. It's such a great place. But she left Copenhagen and headed off into, mainly to Italy, where she appeared in a bunch of films. And I think we perhaps have to mention one of the greatest films on her CV, of course, is The Wild, Wild Planet.
Yeah, she's got an uncredited role in there. She's one of the pretty ladies who do the abductions in that film.
Shrink people down to size. Which is great. She's in some other classic Italian films from that period, like OK Connery and...
Deadlier Than the Mail,
Deadlier Than the Mail, which is a really fun film, British sort of spy comedy type thing. And yeah, she's in a few other Euro spy films, lots of stuff, but mainly, like, if you read her credits, I guess it's sort of typical of the period, but she's things like prostitute, girl in shower, girl in bed with Tony. That one's in No Tears for a Killer, where she's in bed with Franco Nero. What else is she? Dancer.
Water ski girl.
Yeah, girl in a harem. Girl on beach. So, yeah, that's just typical of the 60s. She's even in Barbarella, actually.
Yeah, another girl, girl in something girl. Uncredited. Yeah.
And I believe she was modeling at the same time as well, so it's not like she was stuck for work. But
what I think is interesting is that you could see very clearly that there came a point in about 67 where suddenly she's in four different jungle epics, two Gungala films and two Tarzan films. And it's just like, oh, okay, so they apparently think they found her niche at that point, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so she was cast as in the lead role, which must have been pretty exciting for somebody who's spent most of their career uncredited. In the first Gungala film, and then that led to almost immediately to a sequel, and then like you said, she's in she plays an Amazon queen in a film called Tarzan en la Gruta del Oro, which is
Tarzan in the Golden Grotto,
which is a Spanish co-production. In some films she's referred to as Zan as well. There's a character called Zan rather than Tarzan.
Yeah, I'm interested in seeing Tarzan in the Golden Grotto. Just because I'm curious about Tarzan films altogether, but also because one of the listed, I have a real interest in two of the listed screenwriters on that, Umberto Lenzi and Joaquin Luis Romero as well, who is, Joaquin Luis Romero Marchand, who's a name that if you're familiar with Spanish genre films should perk up your interest, because he was the writer of Cutthroats 9 and a number of other films from that period. So I have a curiosity about Tarzan and the Golden Grotto that is going to make me seek that one out, I should say.
Yeah. And then there was a sequel to that one, which was a Spanish, Italian, and Filipino co-production, called Gungala and the Treasure of Emerald Cave. And that one was made in the early 70s. And so that one, of course, if anyone knows the story of Kitty Swan, is where there was a terrible accident on set. Now, I'm a bit confused because I've read about this. And apparently, so it's a Spanish, Italian, Filipino co-production, but they were shooting a scene in Florida and that's where the accident actually happened.
Yeah.
Which is just bizarre in itself. So I've got the details here. So it says, while filming in Rainbow Springs, Florida, in 1970, some unskilled pyrotechnicians, which sounds to me like they just hired some cheap local people, caused a terrible fire during the shooting of a scene where Kitty and her co-star, Steve Hawks, who played Tarzan, who incidentally, Steve Hawks, that's not his real name. Yeah, he was Eastern European. That's
yeah, I'm not sure. I've always just called him Steve Hawks. I've never seen it. Well,
yeah, also his surname is Stepan Sipek. That was his real name, from Zagreb. And he had been abandoned by his parents and raised on his own, very poor, but he became a really good swimmer. And that was how he ended up, he won a swimming marathon across Lake Ontario, which kind of got him some fame. And that's how he ended up as the new Tarzan, which isn't that similar to Johnny Weissmuller? Wasn't he a swimmer originally?
Yeah, Johnny Weissmuller was an Olympic gold medal winning swimmer, and that's how he ended up playing Tarzan. Yeah, yeah.
I think swimmers have the right shaped bodies to be Tarzans.
They have the correct lean physique.
Yeah,
yes,
quite triangular. Anyway, so yeah, so there's this terrible fire. There's a scene where, and this scene is in the movie, up until the bit where obviously it went wrong. But they've basically been tied onto these stakes. And there's also a lion there as well. And in the scene, the lion was supposed to leap free and save them from the fire. But it went wrong. I think there was petrol involved.
Mm.
And the whole thing went up. The flames got out of control. And the crew couldn't put it out quick enough. And the lion did manage to get free and saved Steve Hawks, like it had been trained to do. And that... So he was less badly injured than she was. And actually, he was so kind of... His life was changed so much by that that he started a charity, like a foundation, to look after big cats. Because his life had been saved by this one making the film. But unfortunately, she was very badly burned.
Yeah.
She could barely walk. She had all these scars. She couldn't move her hands or arms, and that was it. That was the end of her career. Really quite awful.
It's a very sad story, and it is incredibly unfortunate. It is one of the horror stories of that period of European exploitation filmmaking. It's just incompetent people, I mean, almost killing people and disfiguring them for life. It's awful.
Yeah, and it just sounds like safety was not on everyone's minds, rather than just doing it as cheaply as possible.
Yeah, yeah.
And But what's interesting, there's a sort of interesting postscript to this story, and it's a bit of a miracle, really. So this was in the papers that experts had told her that there wasn't much they could do for her burns and she'd have to have plastic surgery. So this was a sort of made international news. And in Montenegro, there was a guy called Jovan, I can't pronounce these names at all, but Jovan Seljic, who lived in a little town in Montenegro. And he saw this in a magazine and he got in touch with them to say that he could heal. I think he wrote a letter, actually, to the magazine, and then it eventually got passed all the way along. He was a herbalist, and he claimed to have secret herbal remedies that could cure burns. So she got on a plane wrapped up in blankets and flew to Montenegro and met this guy, and he healed her. And he regenerated her looks, got rid of her scars, returned the elasticity to her skin, and basically she just became healed. And I've seen photos of her taken later in the 70s, and she's not all sort of scarred like you would expect.
Hmm.
So it's really quite amazing. And so
does anyone have any idea of what was actually done?
Well, it's secret apparently, but it's just he has the
was the secret plastic surgery? I'm just curious.
Well, apparently not. So I'm looking at this news article from Montenegro News that talks about it, that it's just this sort of secret traditional herbal remedy. So who knows? But she left in 1971 completely cured. While she was there, she met a guy who was a singer, local singer, Toma Zrad. Dear me. Toma Zdravkovic, and together in 1971, so this is after she was healed, they recorded a single. So she made a record in, it says here Yugoslavia. Well, I guess it was Yugoslavia at the time. I'm afraid my Eastern European geography knowledge is embarrassing. According to Discogs, it was released in Yugoslavia. But yeah, so she made a record while she was there. So I will put a clip of that. It's called Pesma o Kitty Swan.
Baš juče slušam pesmu tu i plačem ja. Tvoj bol je velik, Kitty Swan. Za mene si ti divan cvet u srcu mom. Za mene si tužna pesma, Kitty Swan. Za mene si ti divan cvet u srcu mom. Za mene si tužna pesma, Kitty Swan.
To Google, Pesma translates as cough, and that can't be right. Anyway, whatever it is, Pesma o Kitty Swan. So it's a sort of folky ballad, folk pop ballad, and there's a picture of her on the front cover, and she looks great. I mean, she's covering part of her face with her hair.
Okay.
Maybe that's to cover up some scars, I don't know, but she's on the vinyl. On this 45 inch, there she is. So I will tweet that picture out as well. And so anyway, so that's the story of what happened to her then. And she went back to Italy. She married her great love, Roberto Casali. And then that might be all, except I found in a forum, if you're interested, if you're keeping up with this great story. So our friend of the podcast, Matt Blake, the writer of the Eurospy Guide and the Italian sci-fi book that started this whole podcast in the first place, he wrote about her on his blog, The Wild Eye. And there was a comment left about 3 years ago by somebody called Steen Svanholm. And he says, for everyone with interest in the person, I can tell that Kirsten, who is Danish, she has double citizenship, so she's Danish Italian citizenship, is very much alive and well. She lives just outside Rome with her husband. She is still a very beautiful, open-hearted, and wise woman. Despite the burn accident, during which her husband and family stood by her side, she later gave birth to two children. Today, she lives a quiet but very active life with great interest in Roman and Etruscan culture and architecture. She is also a skilled painter and sculptor and among the most knowledgeable people, though not documented, concerning ancient Roman marble and pottery, and she is my very cherished aunt. So there you go. So Steen Svanholm, his auntie is Kitty Swan. So quite a happy end, hopefully.
Well, one could hope so, because my goodness, the thing that took her out of her movie career was simply a tragedy.
Yeah, terrible. So it looks like things worked out okay, and so that was written, so that's 4 years ago. And she's only, I just looked it up, she would be 70 if she's still alive, which I'm assuming she's 70. So yeah, very interesting. I mean, I don't know if I've done all the talking there as I've gone through her life, or is there anything you want to add about your experience of watching Kitty Swan films or knowledge of Kitty Swan?
Well, that's the thing, is her career. I mean, it was just, I hate to say it this way, but it really was just kind of flowering. Who knows what doors would have opened for her after, yeah, you know, once we get into the 1970s, there's no telling whatsoever. She certainly was very obviously game for whatever the exploitation world was offering her. And one can only assume that there would have probably been a few more Jungle Girl movies in her future, but probably also other things as well. Who knows how long her career might have been? And it is a real shame. I'm just glad that she was able to eventually find happiness outside the movie industry. I enjoy her performance in this. I've enjoyed her when I've spotted her in her smaller roles and other things as well. And it is one of those sad little things. But I'm still gratified every time I reflect on that story about her life. Because I've run across that tale more than a few times when she's popped up in different movies. I'm appalled, because you simply think about how far out of the way so many productions will go to save a buck, and to put people in actual physical danger is just it's reprehensible, and so it's. I'm just glad that, as you say, her life took a turn for the better afterwards.
Yeah. I mean, she's, you know, there's no getting around this. She was beautiful.
Oh, yes.
In this film and in the other films and the imagery that I've seen as I've been doing this research. I think she could easily have been like another Edwidge Fenech.
Possibly.
And gone along a similar path, or Barbara Boucher, and, you know, she would have popped up in Giallo and Plitzia-Tesky films, and maybe even if she was lucky, she'd have got a few comedies, school teacher comedies. Who knows?
Who knows?
Yeah. Anyway, speaking of Edwidge Fenech, she's going to pop up in one of our future films, because she also was a Jungle Girl. So that's something to look forward to.
So many Jungle Girls. I mean, well, here's the thing. I knew that I had the trump card with Audrey Hepburn and being a Jungle Girl in a movie, but my goodness, if you look at the list of actresses, well, think of it this, like Catherine Schell, she played Lana, Queen of the Amazons, in a German film in 1964. Would you join me in thinking that maybe the classic Doctor Who character of Leela, the companion of Tom Baker's Doctor Who, would kind of be in the category of Jungle Girl? I mean, she's kind of that savage thing, you know. That seems very much in that, you know, in that vein.
Yeah, she's either a Jungle Girl or a kind of 1 million years BC girl.
Yeah, yeah, something along those lines. You know, the Sheena things. There are all these kinds of Italian, you know, takeoffs on Tarzan, including something we will touch on later on in this short series, Tarzana, which, of course, you know, you just add a vowel to the end of it and suddenly it's a woman.
That's it. You only need to add an A to any name and it becomes a Jungle Girl name.
But if one were to line up all the various, even just cinema Jungle Girls, if you were to ignore the pulp stories and the comic book stories and just concentrate on the ones on screen, it's like, you know, who's your favorite? Was it the Panther Girl of the Congo? Was it Kilma, Queen of the Jungle? Was it Leela, who was played by Valerie Leon in one of the Carry On films? I mean, it's like there's so many. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, don't make me pick my favorite. That's too hard. I mean, speaking of Valerie Leon, I've interviewed her years ago. She's lovely. And she was the Queen of the Jungle in the film Queen Kong. So that's very much a Jungle Girl film, if we're going to sort of stretch it that far. Queen Kong is absolutely terrible and hilarious.
It is both of those things. I agree with you 100%.
She plays the Queen of the Jungle. So let's get into some plots here, which won't take long.
No, it will not.
I mean, thankfully, we should say this film is not really very easily commercially available, and that's perhaps why there's a distinct lack of reviews and attention. It is on a French DVD. Artus put out a DVD about 10 years ago, but it's not English friendly. It's not got English subtitles or the English track. There was a VHS, I think, in English. So what I did for us to be able to watch it. There is a print on YouTube, mm-hmm. which might be taken from the DVD, that's in Italian. So I took that one, and then I took the English language track from a very poor quality VHS copy on archive.org, and I put the two together, and they more or less sync up. There's a few scenes where it's a bit out of sync, but for the most part it kind of works. But yeah, maybe that's why there's less attention, but there, I think there's even less attention with the other films. So at least we have this film does get a mention in a book, which is more than can probably be said for some of the other ones. So I've got a plot summary here from the Deodato book, and it starts with some footage that I assumed was just stock footage left over from one of Jacopetti's Mondo Carne type films.
Yeah.
But according to what it said about what Deodato said in that interview, he went to Africa to shoot. So maybe that stuff was shot by Deodato as well, which I think makes it worse in some ways. Because it says here in the beginning, Gungala La Pantera Nuda begins with some documentary-style imagery accompanied by a spoken commentary in the spirit of a Mondo movie. It is, isn't it? It's very much a Mondo film, the style.
Oh, yeah. This gibberish at the beginning. I mean, well, not gibberish, but it's just this... It's almost like you're seeing the beginning of some kind of documentary. Africa is vibrant, modern, and alive.
But just pop down the road, and it's just full of topless girls dancing around. Did you notice how much the camera just kept zooming in on boobs?
Yes. I love the fact that we slam cut from the voiceover and footage showing us the modern cities in Africa, you know, indicating as the voiceover does, hey, you know, really, Africa in its cityscapes and in its modern urban areas is just very much like, you know, every place you grew up, and they name, you know, multiple cities in Europe. Yeah. And then slam cut straight into, oh, and by the way, topless native women.
And oh, it's not great, especially if it was Deodato actually directing that stuff. Tricky as to how much I want to talk about that. But I would guess at the ages of some of those girls were what we would say they were underage for appearing topless in a film.
To a degree, I understand. Well, let's put it this way: I understand your being uncomfortable with this footage. At the same time, this is exactly the same kind of footage that you would see in a National Geographic documentary.
Yeah,
you know, from the 40s through today. This is not something that I consider to be exploitative, other than the exploitative nature of the fact that they're using this footage in, you know, this kind of ridiculous style of story.
Yeah. And I get the sense, because none of it really has much of a bearing on the plot. I feel like to a degree it's just padding to try and get the runtime up. Like, well, we need five
padding or, you know, freebie nudity. I mean, there's always that.
And then we cut to an opening credit sequence where basically, I don't know about you, but I was reminded of the Edwidge Fenech film that we watched a while ago, where she's running topless through the woods wearing a chastity belt. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do. That is one of the few of those Italian comedies that really stood out for some reason. I can't imagine. Yeah. Maybe you just described the reason that stood out.
We get a similar opening credit sequence here, which is just Gungala running mostly naked through the... she's running with zebras. She's running across the savannah. She's jumping into the waves. She's, just nude for the whole credit sequence. I mean, I don't know. Was that okay in 1968 in Italy? I guess it was. I mean, it wouldn't have been here. That would have all been cut right out. But
This is what makes me wonder. And this is why, you know, in the world in which I want to live, we suddenly have this incredible interest in Jungle Girl films, and there is this massive series of releases of in-depth looks at various Jungle Girl films, and both the Gungala films are put out in a double feature set packed with extras. And we learn what I suspect, which is that there were probably at least 2, 3, or 4 variations on the opening credit sequence.
Yeah, possibly. So that's quite funny. And then, but she's not naked for any point in the rest of the film. It's just the opening credits.
I know. Very strange. Interesting.
So an insurance company, alerted by a rich English family, organizes an expedition to find the heiress to an industrial empire. I think it's basically a diamond mine, isn't it?
Yes.
Who was given up for lost in Africa following an airplane disaster in which her parents were killed. The Europeans, this is a big summary. The Europeans find Gungala and one of the explorers falls in love with her. That's basically the plot summary from the book. And then they describe it as a feminine version of a Tarzan film. They talk about how she's nicknamed the daughter of the Bird of Fire. So she's running around the jungle wearing a diamond on a string.
Right.
Which is somehow connected with a statue in the jungle that's...
Right. From what I understand, that statue has some kind of religious significance, and that diamond was one of the eyes of this statue that got... And I'm assuming this all took place in the first film, because they keep describing it as having happened in the past. So, because
she's just wearing it around her neck, and they treat her like she's a god or something.
Mm-hmm.
Although the plot is so basic, I also found it quite confusing. So you've got this group, basically they get together, this party, to go into the jungle to find Gungala. And amongst the party is Julie, who is Gungala's cousin, I think?
Yes.
Who wants to be the heiress herself. But if they find Gungala, Gungala gets it all and not Julie. Or they split it 50-50, I think. And they take a big party out into the jungle. And these are where we get some actual scenes in the jungle where they're crossing a river. And they've got a lot of sort of local Africans helping them.
Right.
And then they all step off the boat, and immediately every single one of their helpers is shot down by spears and arrows by the local tribe.
I know. That was the moment at which I thought, ah-ha-ha, so this film is going to have some violence and action. Alrighty then.
But what I want to know is, what did they do with the bodies?
Oh, we leave them laying there, and much like a video game, we ignore them and they go away.
Yeah, because in the next scene, they've just set up camp in the clearing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, what did you do with all those dead people?
Well, we're left to surmise that they must have just rolled them off into the river.
Yeah, and they didn't seem the slightest bit bothered. One of the guys was still alive, and he's like reaching out to them, and they're just completely ignoring him.
One of them is about to shoot this guy, and our supposed hero, the blonde fellow, says, "Oh well, don't shoot him. He's one of ours." And then they just stand there and resume their conversation. They don't go over to him. They don't offer him any first aid.
No, just leave him completely. Oh, yeah, so we've got two guys. One, I'm a bit confused about who they were. One is a jungle expert. I think that's Chandler.
No. Morton is the jungle expert. That's okay. Angelo Infante.
Chandler is the blonde guy with the worst moustache I think I've ever seen in a film.
It's like it still hasn't grown all the way in, like he's a teenager, yes.
Oh, it's terrible. It's a mistake. Somebody should have told him it was a mistake.
Somebody needs to speak to him about his facial hair.
Just take him to one side and say, "Dude, please, it's not working.
It's not. Dude, it's not happening." Well, somebody probably had a conversation with him, because I think this is the only movie that particular actor, Jeff Tangen, this is it. This is the only movie he made.
Right.
So maybe people laughed at his facial hair and he left cinema.
I mean, he's pretty wooden, let's be fair.
The dubbing on him isn't too bad. I'll give him that. The dubbing adds something to it. But
so there's some sort of a relationship going on between him and Julie, I think, but it's not very clear, because he's come along for the ride because he knows where Gungala is. He's met her before.
Apparently in the previous movie, but there's no indication that he was in that movie, so yeah.
But then at one point, Morton bumps into Gungala, and he sort of falls in love with her a bit, I think. And she's just hovering around. She's on the periphery of their camp and just watching what's going on. And then Julie decides that the best way to bring Gungala out into the open is if she dresses like Gungala herself. So Gungala has made a dress for herself out of what looks like just, I don't know, plastic netting or something.
Well, I thought, I kept going back and forth. I thought, is it like upholstery from the crashed plane? Is it some kind of mesh net, you know, fabric of some sort? It's hard to know, other than I will say this. Clearly, as the movie shows us, it is magical because it never moves from covering her breasts.
Yeah, she's also got some sellotape that she rescued from the crash.
It must have been, yes.
And sticks it down. But Julie appears to magically have some of this same material. Mm-hmm. She makes herself a dress out of it as well. And so now you've got two of them who look quite similar because they're cousins walking through the jungle, and the local tribe kidnap Julie because they think she is Gungala and they want to kill her or sacrifice her to their god. There's also, in the background of all this, there was a guide who they wanted them, who they asked to take them into the jungle, and he said no.
Yeah.
But then he's secretly teaming up with a guy who's just credited as Arab.
No.
So there is an Arab who wants to do something. I'm not entirely sure. He's trying to kill them all off as well, I think.
Yeah,
so
I think he's pretty guy. Much after the diamond mine that they
he
assume
the
is... Yeah, exactly.
Now, the other guy, he's uncredited as far as I can tell. I can't find his name in the credits. But I think he was in The Snow Devils. I'm sure I recognize him from The Snow Devils, yeah. But anyway, so there's sort of some intrigue going on in the background. And then this Gungala just having a lovely time with her friend, the Black Panther. And she has another friend who's a chimpanzee. And she also has some parrots. Incidentally, I learned on the radio this morning that there is no such thing as a panther.
I'm sorry, there's...
That panthers are actually just leopards. They're just...
Really?
They're just more black. But they're exactly the same. They're not a separate animal. So,
wow.
There you go.
Wow. An assumption from my jungle adventure reading has now been dashed on the rocks. I wish I'd never learned this. My childhood
panthers
is ruined.
Anyway, I'm struggling to describe the plot here, Rod. Help me out. What else can we say about what happens in this film?
Well, I think what I would say primarily about this film is this is, I hate to put it this strangely, but at the same time, this is a typical one of these films. This is a good example of this type of film. And your expressions of mild confusion about the plot and the story, honestly, I understand. Part of that is cleared up if you have the wherewithal to watch the film more than once, because it is all spelled out within the dialogue once you are doing more than just mildly paying attention to how well it's kind of forming up against all the other variations on this same theme. These movies are much of a sameness. There is a quality to these movies in which they tread the same pathways with mild variations pretty much every time. There's not a lot that you're going to find within this genre that isn't something you haven't seen in one form or another. They're very similar kinds of movies. And I know that for a lot of people, that will knock down your ability to enjoy these for what they are, which is a bit of a shame, because it is the joys of these films do really kind of fall well within the kind of standard jungle adventure thing. If you enjoy the types of adventure stories that these are putting on screen, you're going to be good, and you're going to kind of enjoy picking out the slight variations, the change-ups, the way they get to the different places that these stories almost always end up going. And at the same time, I can understand being somewhat confused and feeling that the films are kind of, in some cases they are, just excuses to parade a beautiful naked woman around and pretend that she's Tarzan. And that's okay. But at the same time, these films are not everybody's cup of tea. I can very much understand somebody listening to us talk about these movies and never having the slightest urge to watch them. But there are joys to be had in these movies. For instance, I'm kind of weird and reluctant to admit this. I kind of enjoy the music in this film. I don't think it's the greatest score I've ever heard in my life, and I suspect that it was probably commissioned for some other film before it got used for this. I have no idea, no way to know. Not exactly sure, but the joys of these kinds of stories are they're related very much to whatever enjoyment you might have ever had to Jungle Epics. Now, here's the big downside that I think you're going to have to admit to with Jungle Girl movies, no matter what.
Okay.
They never have the kinds of really fun action that you hope you're going to get. In other words, if what you're looking for is the kind of rough and tumble action that you would get from a Tarzan film, where Tarzan is involved in fighting bad guys and clubbing people over the head and doing things of that nature. It is a very rare Jungle Girl movie that is going to offer up that kind of thing. The actresses are not asked to put themselves in the position of taking on bad guys, fighting in hand-to-hand combat, doing anything of that nature. And
they don't wrestle crocodiles either.
No, they do not. But
there are quite a lot of crocodiles in this film, actually.
quite a lot. What you end up with is the Jungle Girl being presented as someone who kind of lives in harmony with nature around her. And I don't know if that is a choice made to differentiate the Jungle Girls from, say, the Tarzan kind of, you know, white savage in the jungle, or if it is something that is done because, hey, we're hiring a model. We don't want to shove her in front of a lion.
Understandable. Yeah, I mean, like it says in the book here, she encompasses all the stereotypes. She speaks with the animals, has a great sense of justice, punishes the abusers of power, and is in effect the sheriff of the jungle.
Right. And that to me is one of the things I often find myself, I'll find a new Jungle Girl movie and get all excited because I like Jungle Girl movies, and I'll find myself waiting, hoping, thinking, hey, yeah, cool, let's see the action. And the action that's going to be in these movies is going to be like the things we've already described, which is when native tribesmen attack, you know, the porters and bearers of the safari that is moving through their jungle. That's the action. You don't get a savage jungle girl with a knife in her hand, you know, attacking scumbags and righting wrongs. That's not these stories. And I'll admit, that is a frustration for me. But I guess I long ago just kind of embraced the fact that these are not Tarzan stories. As much as I might want there to be a full-on, you know, attack the scumbag bad guys kind of Jungle Girl movie, those are few and far between. Strangely enough, the 1984 Sheena with Tanya Roberts actually comes pretty close to that. There's some good action sequences in that. And it's clear that they picked an actress who was willing to kind of go the distance and do the stuff that you're kind of hoping a Jungle Girl movie might eventually have. So if you go into one of these movies hoping for something along the lines of a Tarzan movie with as far as the action, you're going to be disappointed. So you're going into these, I guess it's better to kind of go into these movies with more of an eye toward sexploitation. That's more what these are. There's some adventure stuff involved and some nature footage and maybe a little jungle intrigue. But, you know, these aren't Gordon Scott or Johnny Weissmuller Tarzan movies. No. They're not action movies, unfortunately.
Just one last thing I wanted to mention from the book. According to the reviewer, he says that Kitty Swan ostentatiously shows off her hairy armpits.
I mean,
I don't know which version of the film he was watching, but that wasn't something that I noticed particularly. I thought, considering she's grown up in the jungle, she was very well groomed. I mean, she clearly, she's in that, in the plane crash, was clearly a bucket load of mascara and eyeliner and hairspray.
Yes, and clearly, you know, nail and hair care products of some sort.
Yeah, yeah. Or maybe it's just, I don't know, she washes her hair with banana or something, but she looks like she just stepped out of the salon.
Yeah, like she just visited a day spa and is looking forward to the afternoon.
Yeah. But there you go. So that is Gungala La Pantera Nuda. I also forgot to mention, Rod, and I feel almost now like I have to do this in every episode, is that Kitty Swan's first film was I Due Pericoli Pubblici, which translates as The Two Public Dangers. Now, can you guess what kind of film that might be? Just based on the title. The Two Public Dangers.
Two Public Dangers. It's a comedy. I'm going to assume it was a comedy.
Who might the two public dangers be?
Oh, no. It's not that comedy duo, is it?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
So she was in a Franco Egidio film in 1964, playing an English tourist in a museum. And
they're like a rotting thread of Italian cheese pushing its way through the very fabric of cinema. It's frightening.
It's like all roads lead back to Franco and Chicho. And because in fact she was in another one a year later called Gli Amanti Latini, or The Latin Lovers, where she is girl doing exercises on the beach, and she's in a bikini in that one, and she and Franco goes nuts when he sees her. So there you go. So she's actually in two Franco and Chicho comedies, 64 and 65.
Back in the decades when merely having an absolutely gorgeous woman scantily clad on screen for your comedians to react humorously to was comedy.
Yep, there we are. So, you know, I couldn't let that go.
Well, Adrian, I do have a question for you about this film and kind of the genre overall.
Uh-huh.
How familiar are you with the Jungle Girl subgenre to begin with?
Oh, totally unfamiliar.
Ah, good. Okay, so what did you think of this example?
So apart from seeing pictures in some of the books, like obviously there are pictures of this one in the Diodato book, so that was when I was first aware. But I wasn't particularly aware that there was a whole subgenre and that there were a bunch of these films. So, I mean, I enjoyed it. It's entertaining for what it is. Mm-hmm. It wasn't going to win any awards. Mm. And obviously the main reason that most people are going to come and watch this is because of Kitty Swan. It's certainly not for the brilliantly written dialogue or thrilling plot twists. But yeah, because obviously, as I mentioned, she spends quite a lot of the film just watching, and then by the end of the movie, she jumps into action to save the white people from the tribe, and she uses her power over the animals. There's a bit where she rides an elephant.
Yeah, they overcome the evil Arab, which is just...
Yes. Oh, yeah, who sinks in quicksand.
Yeah. Well, see, that's just it. I didn't want to necessarily bring this up because then my childhood terror returns, but this is a film that does emphasize the deadly nature of quicksand and how it can sneak right up on you.
When we were growing up, I honestly thought I was going to die in quicksand. Like, it just seemed to be everywhere.
Well, I did for a long time think that it might be a good idea to just carry around a length of rope just in case you needed it because of quicksand.
Do you remember that show Manimal in the 80s?
Oh, I did not see it when it was broadcast, but I do know what you're talking about.
Yeah. Yes. I remember an episode of that where there's a guy sinking in quicksand, so Manimal turns himself into a snake. So he can be used like a rope to pull himself out.
I'm sorry, I was wanting to finish that sentence with, so Manimal turns himself into a snake so that he can laugh at him.
That's my main memory of, yeah, everything seemed to be people sinking in quicksand all the time in the 80s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But obviously, you know, this is the 60s and it was still a thing. You don't see quicksand around so much these days, thankfully.
Yeah, they're almost as invisible as rotary dial phones. It's just they don't exist anymore.
Yeah, it's fine. Yeah, no, I enjoyed this one. I'm looking forward to the next one, which is going to be Luana the Jungle Girl.
Oh, good.
And if anybody wants to play along at home, that is on YouTube in a relatively okay, watchable, it's okay, English language print. So, yeah, so don't miss that one. Now, before we finish today, I know we're running a bit long, but I wanted to mention we've had quite a lot of feedback that I wanted to share with you before we go.
Please, good.
So, based on our last episode where we talked about Warriors of the Lost World. So, Lee Perkins got in touch. Hi, Lee. Thanks for listening. He says, this is the only time in my life I will ever get to brag about this with anyone who even remotely cares. I have an autographed picture of Mega Weapon, which is the huge sort of armored truck from the film.
The
he says, on the Mystery Science disc, David Worth gave out his email address.
Yes.
That's pretty funny.
He did.
So I dropped him a line and became quite friendly. Really nice guy, very knowledgeable about film, especially cinematography. So he sent me the picture, I'm going to tweet it out, of Robert Ginty and Mega Weapon. And it is signed by David Worth. So how about that? He also mentions that Tenebrae is a post-apocalyptic film in case we do a sequel series. So is it? I need to look into that one. Is it set in the future? I can't remember. I asked him if it was okay to share the picture, and he says, not sure about sharing the picture. It may devalue it. It's currently worth £4 on eBay. He also keeps accidentally calling it Mega Truck instead of Mega Weapon, which I think is probably easy to do. He says that he has a YouTube channel called Psychotronic Films and Television, so he was collating anything on YouTube that's in Michael Weldon's book. So do check him out, Psychotronic Films and Television. He collates stuff that's already there, so he also looks for the films that are mentioned in podcasts. So he listens to Wild Podcast. He listens to Bloody Pit, Neshicast, Monster Kid Radio. And he's got a Psychotronic Films playlist. So there is a one-stop shop of podcasts that are connected to the films. So, I mean, that all sounds great, Lee. So thanks very much for including us there.
Yes, very much.
So I will put a link in the show notes to the YouTube channel Psychotronic Films and Television. So thank you, Lee. Also, just quick, we've been getting some traction on Twitter, partly because I tweeted out the other day that we just hit 15,000 downloads. So thank you, everybody, for downloading. 15,000, that's pretty good going. I mean, well, you know, 2 years. Very small, very specific podcast. I'm quite pleased with that.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty good going. So people have been suggesting other things that we could do. Holger Hasse, whose name I always pronounce wrong. Sorry, Holger. He suggested a series featuring Gloria Jueda or Edwidge Fennec.
Sure, that'd be good. I have no problem with either of those.
No, although the pictures that he's posted for those are both comedies. So the school teacher ones, or the ones where Edwidge Fennec plays a policewoman.
Holger, I'm trying to avoid the Italian comedies, man. Come on.
And someone else also suggested some Lino Banfi, and has tweeted a photo from Il Commissario. Oh, sorry, the poster from Il Commissario Logato. So that I don't know what that film is, but the poster makes it look like a sort of James Bond style comedy. So maybe. We'll keep all the suggestions coming in. We've also had some feedback on Instagram. Mark Eggins got in touch again and says, I heard you guys mention Howard Vernon in Dispatches.
Yes.
What a journeyman career he had. Even turned up in a quirky art house flick later on called Les Champignons de Carpathes, or the Carpathian Mushrooms, from 1990. About a miraculous mushroom discovered by a film director's daughter to cure an actress. Never heard of that one, but there you go. Howard Vernon is in that too.
Howard Vernon's career is just astonishing. You could watch Howard Vernon films for days and just, I mean, possibly months and never run out.
Yep, No, he apparently plays the head of a small Shakespearean theatre troupe, which sounds fun. Also, Eddie Crosby got in touch and mentioned, I think we talked about the film Illustrious Corpses, and he said Francesco Rossi, the director, was known as Italy's social conscience, making absorbing political thrillers during the years of Lead. He's barely talked about nowadays, but his films made the rounds of repertory cinemas in the early 80s. Yeah. Films like The Matei Affair, which won the Palme d'Or. So they don't, he said, don't expect car chases and shootouts, but they're a good contrast to the Poliziotteschi genre. So, yeah, a bit more sort of serious messages. Now, he actually sent us that one a while ago, but I only just saw it. So apologies for that. Yes. Oh, he accidentally said repository cinemas, which was quite funny. He did, of course, mean repertory cinemas, which, as I said, is a very different kind of viewing experience if you go to a repository cinema.
Yes. Yes.
And then Forrest Walking, who is our friend from Finland, I think, if I've got that right. He got in touch just asking us where he could watch Gungala. So I did actually send him the link to the version of the film that I put together. I don't know if that's breaking any copyright rules or not, but if anyone else wants to watch Gungala and they want to see my English language mashup version, then get in touch and I'll send you a link. But only if you do that in the next couple of weeks, because at some point I'll probably have to just delete it in case I get into too much trouble. Anyway, so there you go. So it's great to hear from people. Please do get in touch. We like hearing from you on Twitter or Instagram or the email, which is just wildwildpodcast@gmail.com. Or we are the Wild Wild Pod on Twitter. And on Instagram, we are Wild Wild Podcast. So hopefully that's not too confusing. Rod, I didn't ask you at the beginning, but is there anything you want to plug before we finish?
Oh, my goodness. Nothing specific, just the podcasts keep rolling along.
Mm-hmm.
There will be some announcements soon from you and I and
hope so.
Troy Gwynn and myself about some upcoming commentary tracks, of course.
Yes.
But other than that, the podcast keeps rolling along. I've got a Star Trek 3 episode coming out very soon. We've got some stuff coming up for the month of October leading up to Halloween involving, as you put the bug in my ear, I'm going to do an episode of The Bloody Pit with two or three episodes of The Inner Sanctum old radio show, just to kind of give people a flavor of that for the holiday
Excellent.
Season.
Yes, I enjoyed your Inner Sanctum podcast, so yes. If anyone who's listening to this hasn't heard that, do head over to The Bloody Pit and check that out. Well, thank you, Rod. Thank you again for doing this. It's fun to be back in a new themed season. And thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll be back in a couple of weeks into the jungle again. So get your loincloths in the wash.
And get your suntan oil.
Yeah, get ready to stick all that back on and listen to the next episode. I don't know what I'm talking about. Right. That'll do, I think. Thanks, everybody. And here again, in case you weren't listening properly the first time, here's our wonderful jungle-themed podcast theme tune. Bye for now.
Bye, everyone.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.